right now the borders are sealed, and I think the movement toward the borders happened before the bombing started, and then the people saw that they were sealed, so they went back. There's still about 50,000 people on the borders. As soon as those open, the UN has set up operations or places for camps in the tribal area just in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan. That tribal area is a little bit dangerous because there's no law there except the tribal law, the law of the gun.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, it's time for the weekly Freak Show. Headlines and highlights for the week ending Saturday, October 13th, 2001. My name's the V-Man, and I'll be your host for this one-hour look back at the news and features not heard in or glanced over by the corporate-controlled media. On this week's program, we'll hear from Dr. James Jennings of Conscience International about the refugee crisis in Afghanistan. Brian Wilson of Veterans for Peace reacts to the bombings of Afghanistan. And later, we'll hear of the many ways citizens in Santa Cruz are resisting this new war. Plus, this week's Spotlight Sound. Stand by for the weekly Freak Show, coming up next. And now headlines for the week ending Saturday, October 13th, 2001. Under heavy police surveillance, more than 2,000 people turned out in Denver, Colorado for a national convergence dubbed Transform Columbus Day, held from October 5th through 8th. Among the many attendees were indigenous peoples, Chicanos, Mexicanos, African Americans, community activists, environmentalists, peace activists, union workers, and a contingent of anarchists. The people held marches and workshops to celebrate cultural unity and demand an end to the celebration of Columbus Day. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, October 9th, Jim Cosner, who pleaded no contest to a felony charge of malicious vandalism after smashing a marble statue of Christopher Columbus in San Jose's City Hall with a sledgehammer this past March, was sentenced to 10 months in Santa Clara County Jail and will serve about 75 more days. He was ordered to pay as much as $65,000 in restitution and complete 5,250 hours of community service, and upon release must serve a minimum of 15 hours each weekend or face 3 years in prison. Cosner, who is part Native American, has said he tried to destroy the statue because it served as a reminder of the slaughter and conquest of indigenous peoples by early explorers. Hendrik Voss, a German citizen and volunteer for School of the Americas Watch, was illegally detained by U.S. immigration officials on Wednesday, October 10th, after attempting to cross the border into Canada with SOA Watch outreach coordinator Eric LeCompte. The two were detained, interrogated, and searched thoroughly for more than 3 hours by a Canadian immigration official and a U.S. immigration officer, who eventually told LeCompte he would not be admitted into Canada because of a 1995 arrest in Rochester, New York, where he was protesting the fingerprinting of welfare recipients. The pair then turned back and stopped at the U.S. immigration office as instructed, where they were again held. Voss was taken in for further interrogations by a U.S. Border Patrol agent and U.S. immigration official. During his interrogation, the agents went through his journal and copied the writings. At one point, U.S. Border Patrol agent B.C. Rowley bellowed, "So you've been protesting the World Trade Organization," as he slammed the door, leaving Voss alone in the interrogation room. While Eric LeCompte was told he was free to leave, Hendrik Voss was held in custody overnight as INS officials sought to have him deported. The next day, he was released following numerous vigils in his support and a flood of phone calls and emails to the German consulate. At no time was Hendrik Voss suspected of committing a crime. Opposition to the construction of Ecuador's new heavy crude oil pipeline has intensified in recent days. The building of the pipeline along its current route will devastate 11 sensitive forest areas and lead to the doubling of oil production from national parks and other protected areas in Ecuador's Mindo-Nambio cloud forest. The Mindo area includes steep and unstable slopes where there is a high risk of oil spills. In May, the country's existing pipeline ruptured due to a landslide, spilling 7,000 barrels of crude. It was the 14th major oil spill since 1998. Unsuccessful in attempts to use legal challenges to change the planned route of the pipeline, environmental groups have put pressure on a consortium of investment companies responsible for the financial backing behind the pipeline. Backers include TechInkt, Alberta Energy, Respol YPF, AGIP, Kerr McGee, Occidental Petroleum, WestLB, Germany's largest bank, Citigroup, and Argentinian oil company Perez Compank, who own drilling rights to areas within Ecuador's Yasuni National Park. On Thursday, October 11th, dozens of women, many accompanied by children, began to peacefully blockade construction of the OCP pipeline through the Mindo-Nambio cloud forest in Ecuador. Activists from Acción Ecológica and local impacted communities have placed their bodies in the path of destruction and say they will maintain a resistance camp in order to call international attention to their defense of endangered species and ecosystems. They want U.S. energy users to understand that half of the oil from the Ecuadorian pipeline will be destined for West Coast U.S. markets, and urge them to demand a more rapid transition to clean energy alternatives. A detailed study presented in the European Parliament accused Premier Oil, a British-owned oil company, and its French counterpart, Total Fina Elf, were complicit in serious human rights abuses committed by the Burmese military. According to the report released Thursday, October 11th, the companies have benefited financially from the presence of the Burmese military, while the troops there are engaged in widespread and egregious human rights abuses, which have taken place since mid-2000. The document lists numerous incidents of military personnel using forced labor, despite a government order banning it. Marco Simmons from the pressure group Earth Rights International, which compiled the witness statements used in the report, said there were fairly well-documented incidents of villagers being forced to join the military on patrols, carrying heavy loads of supplies and ammunition, exposed to gunfire, and sometimes used as human mine sweepers. The findings will increase the pressure on Premier Oil over its cooperation with a regime whose human rights record has brought it international condemnation. The British Foreign Office is now calling on the company to leave Burma. An out-of-court settlement was reached in a wrongful death suit brought by relatives of David Chain against Maxam Corporation, parent company of Pacific Lumber. Known as Gypsy to friends, the young man was killed on September 17, 1998, in the Grizzly Creek area of the Headwaters Forest Complex when an enraged logger, A.E. Ammons, felled trees in the direction of nonviolent forest defenders looking for possible violations of California's forest practice rules. Despite videotaped evidence of the logger threatening the activists, no criminal charges were ever filed. The killing set off an intense occupation to prevent Maxam employees from disturbing the area that Earth Firsters believed to be a crime scene. After more than 3 years of legal wrangling and direct actions, the company settled out of court on Friday, just days before a trial scheduled on Monday, October 15th. According to the settlement, the tree that killed Gypsy will not be moved, and a 100-foot buffer zone will remain undisturbed. A memorial grove will also be created somewhere on Pacific Lumber land. By settling out of court, Maxam Corporation admits their guilt in the wrongful death of David Gypsy Chain. The settlement also includes a roundtable discussion between Gypsy's mother, Maxam officials and workers, law enforcement personnel, and environmentalists to find solutions to the problem of violence in the forest that plagues Humboldt County. The settlement also provides relatives with an undisclosed monetary award. And finally, much-anticipated anti-terrorism legislation was made law this week.
Immediately following the September 11th terrorist attacks, Ashcroft, it was almost like he was waiting, had a list of things that he wanted to do. He had everything, interestingly enough, including things that he had opposed just a year ago when he was a senator, increased surveillance on bank accounts and the movement of money. It's something that Ashcroft had opposed just a year ago, and now he's in favor of it. A number of other things, some of which are pretty scary, but mostly having to do with indefinite detention of immigrants based solely on just the suspicion of a very low-level INS official doing what they keep referring to as unleashing the CIA, allowing the CIA to investigate inside the United States, allowing the CIA to carry out assassinations, allowing the CIA to openly, I think they never stopped really, but openly and legally contract with people who are obviously involved in human rights violations around the world, that sort of thing. Now, the farther we got away from September 11th, the more sanity came to those positions. They're still not great, but the Congress was actually able to affect that in many ways. For instance, as far as immigrants were concerned, and immigrants are the hardest hit by all of this, they were able to put into the law that immigrants could only be held 7 days without a hearing rather than indefinitely.
That was National Lawyers Guild attorney Dan Mayfield describing to Freak Radio's Old Lady Scar Arms the Uniting and Strengthening America Act, or USA Act of 2001, which was passed by the Senate in a 96-1 vote just before midnight on Thursday, October 11th. Russ Feingold, a Democrat from Wisconsin, cast the lone dissenting vote. Civil libertarians had been urging the Senate to reject the USA Act, saying that it posed significantly more danger to freedom than the House's former Provide Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism Act, or Patriot Act of 2001. That bill, rewritten to match the Senator's fiercer USA Act, was passed by the House 337-79 on Friday, October 12th. The new bills grant the government extensive surveillance powers and the ability to detain U.S. residents and immigrants with no judicial process or other oversight. Laura Murphy of the American Civil Liberties Union commented, "Most Americans do not recognize that Congress has just passed a bill that would give the government expanded power to invade our privacy, imprison people without due process, and punish dissent." And those were headlines for the week ending Saturday, October 13th, 2001. Even before the world focused on Afghanistan as a sanctuary for Osama bin Laden and other terrorists, the country was on the brink of a humanitarian catastrophe, the site of the greatest crisis in hunger and refugee displacement in the world. After 4 years of relentless drought, the worst in three decades, and the total failure of the Taliban government in administering the country, 4 million people have abandoned their homes in search of food in Pakistan, Iran, Tajikistan, and elsewhere, while those left behind eat meals of locusts and animal fodder. 5 million people inside the country are threatened by famine, according to the United Nations. U.S. airstrikes now pounding terrorist sites in Afghanistan may dramatically worsen this situation on the ground. Dr. James Jennings is president of Conscience International, a humanitarian relief organization based in Atlanta, Georgia. He has been involved in humanitarian work for the last 20 years, providing medical treatment to displaced peoples all over the world. This past May, Dr. Jennings was in Afghani refugee camps inside Pakistan. He begins by talking about Conscience International and the focus of the humanitarian relief they provide.
Well, we aim to serve as a link between needs and resources, and particularly the last 10 or 11 years, we've been working in following natural disasters, but also following conflicts and wars in particularly the region, the Middle East and South Central Asia. So, for example, we did earthquake relief in Turkey and in India, and hurricane relief in Honduras, and built houses in those places. But we've done a lot in medical training in Iraq, for example, following the war. We did medical relief and training for doctors and nurses in the hospitals.
This past Sunday, U.S. and British forces began an aerial bombardment campaign in an effort to root out terrorism. And as I mentioned in the introduction, you were in Afghani refugee camps inside Pakistan. I'm wondering what the conditions were like in those camps and how much worse will it become for those people there while this bombing campaign intensifies.
Well, if you can imagine, it's standing in the center of an area surrounded by 50,000 people who have just come over the mountains and camped on this sandy plain in 120-degree heat. And as far as you can see in every direction, there are little thin plastic sheets or tents crowded together, and there's a family of five huddled down in each one of these with no services except water being trucked in. And the Pakistani government did not want them there and said, "We can't handle any more." They already have 2 million refugees.
Wow.
600,000 additional ones have come since the first of the year. So the people were pretty much on their own. If they had money or they could go out and work and get some money, they could buy a little bread. So we set up some bakeries and were able to feed the people for part of the summer until the money ran out and our funding. But now we're trying to put together a coalition of larger agencies that will go in and help them. I mean, we had some people who had never seen this kind of thing before, strong men broke down and cried and wept two or three times while we were going through to visit the camp. But we've been able to provide firewood and bread for baking and even set up some of the bakeries there and help cooperation with other agencies.
What are some of the other obstacles people are facing as they're trying to flee the countryside of Afghanistan?
Right now the borders are sealed, and I think the movement toward the borders happened before the bombing started, and then the people saw that they were sealed, so they went back. There's still about 50,000 people on the borders. As soon as those open, the UN has set up operations or places for camps in the tribal area just in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan. That tribal area is a little bit dangerous because there's no law there except the tribal law, the law of the gun. So it's rather dangerous. Even in Pakistan, in the last few days, the UN buildings have been burned, and some of the staff in Afghanistan has been attacked and beaten. And of course, it doesn't help that the U.S. bombed and killed four of the UN staff in Kabul. But the conditions are bad and expected to get worse. But the sooner the bombing stops, the better.
In addition to dropping bombs, the Bush administration has stated that two aircraft are going to be used for food relief. These food drops, we are told, consist of unrefined wheat, beans, and tomato sauce. In response to these U.S. attacks in Afghanistan, the World Food Program, recently suspended food convoys to the region, although I just read that those were resumed this afternoon. So basically,
yes, 42 trucks are trying to get through now, and we haven't heard whether they did or not.
My question is, from your perspective, this so-called humanitarian aid of the United States, will it have any real value for the Afghani people, or in your opinion, is this being done simply as a tool of propaganda for the consumption of the United States media?
I'm sorry to say that it is totally a propaganda operation. It was put together with the bombing and introduced on the same day of the bombing. And I think that was more to convince the American people that we're really good guys. And the American people respond very well to humanitarian efforts, and so that sounds good. But when you look at it closely, and when you hear from the relief agencies up on the front of the border areas there, they're all saying unequivocally and universally that this is not the way to do humanitarian work. And even the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Rumsfeld, said the same thing when he admitted that, okay, you can't really do it by air, you have to do it by land operation. And also he admitted that cruise missiles are not the way to do it. If those two things are true, then I guess we have to ask the question, why are we doing it?
Can you talk a bit about the numbers? I heard in the first days of this so-called humanitarian relief that we airdropped about 37,000 pounds of food. But as you mentioned, we're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not close to or upwards of a million people. I mean, can you just talk about the effects of, you know, how little amount of food this is?
Well, the figures that I've seen are about 50,000 on the borders, but there are certainly more than a million internally displaced people in Afghanistan that don't have any place to go, and they're camped in various places. But Afghanistan is the size of Texas, and if you try to take two planes and drop this amount from a high altitude, it has a dubious value at best, and you don't know if the people will find the food, will be afraid to eat the food when they find it or not. So there are several problems with that. But if you do the math, you'll see that if the UN was begging for a million tons more of grain from donor nations before this happened, and the deliveries have been suspended for a while, then it's going to take even greater effort to get the wheat and grain and rice into the places where they're needed now. So I think it's not effective what has been done, and it's really just window dressing for the bombing campaign. Now, you can't really destroy Afghanistan. It's already been done. Mm-hmm. The Russians went in there and tried to change the regime and killed a million Afghans while they were in the process of it. During the 1990s, half the refugees in the world were from Afghanistan, and 40% of the buildings in the country have been destroyed. One out of four women is a widow. There are 4 million orphans. 70% of the people are malnourished. Two-thirds of them can't read or write. It's just a dreadful situation. The health statistics are among the worst in the world, very alarming, because the infant mortality rate is, not infant, but under five mortality rate is 257 per thousand, which means that one child in four will die before reaching the age of five. And 16,000 women will die in childbirth this year in Afghanistan.
On the issue of landmines, it's been said that Afghanistan is probably, you know, the worst in the world. The countryside is just littered with landmines from the Soviet war that was there during the 80s. Can you talk a bit about that? Did you experience any anything like that while you were there? And, you know, how is this going to affect people trying to flee right now?
Well, we always have to be aware of that and to go in areas that, not go in areas that are flagged and hope that you don't get in the wrong area.
So they are flagged? There are warning signs posted?
Well, in some areas, I mean, if the UN had a demining operation there, that's the first thing they do is put the flags up, mm-hmm. and then they go around and try to get the mines out. When we were in Iraq, there were a lot of mines that were exploded, so you kept hearing all these explosions day after day. The problem of the mines is one of the most serious in the world, and of course in many places in the world, and the campaign against landmines is a noble humanitarian goal, but it's very difficult with not just the Soviet war, but the 12 years of war that followed in the tribal areas. That's one of the defense mechanisms that they have. Then they don't keep maps of them, and they don't remember where they put them. You know, one of the things that we were helping out with in Afghanistan was one of our sister agencies that was a prosthetics factory where they're manufacturing arms and legs, and so that people can not have to crawl on the ground. There are many, many victims of the 22 years of war. So that's another area. The eye clinics are another area that we've been involved in and have done some funding for. And some of those eye clinics have to go so far out in the hills that there are no roads. You walk for 2 days to get there. So there's no end of the description of the misery and the need.
Another key to what will happen in Afghanistan is the nation of Pakistan. Pakistan's President Musharraf has agreed to give logistical support to American intervention there. To what extent will Pakistan support the U.S., and what are its goals in this support?
I think the risk that Musharraf has taken is a very great one, because it could, in fact, ultimately pull his country apart. The northern frontier provinces are Pashtun, which is identical tribally with the people, 40% of the dominant tribe in Afghanistan, the ones who support the Taliban. So they are very much inflamed by this whole issue and have turned against the West even more than before. Makes it dangerous for aid agencies and UN people to go into those northwest frontier provinces. And Pakistan has a difficult job on its hands, because it could split its country right down the middle. Right now, apparently, the police and army are controlling the demonstration riots, but the UN buildings were burned and other buildings were attacked. So it remains to be seen how volatile that situation will be. But there's another situation that's on the verge of warfare for several years, and that is between India and Pakistan over Kashmir, and both sides feel very strongly about it, and both sides now have nuclear weapons. But Pakistan deserves a lot of the blame for installing the Taliban regime in Kabul, helping them out, and then also of promoting these radicals or allowing them to have these madrasas in which they teach the radical doctrine. They've encouraged that, and now they're reaping the rewards of that, which are very bitter.
I've read recent media reports that China has been moving troops to its borders with Tajikistan and other nations in the area. This is a sign of a larger military operations in the area, and that this is just going to increase and get worse and intensify. How do you feel about this?
China has a great interest in what is happening in Central Asia and in that part of the world. Their main interests are Tibet and what they call Xinjiang province in the northwest part of China, which has been annexed. The people in that province are mostly Turkey people called Uyghurs, and the Uyghurs want to have their own state like the other people in the region do, and there are millions of them, and the Chinese, of course, are suppressing that. So if things get out of hand, it could increase the unrest in the northwest province of China, Xinjiang province. But I think the more serious problem is for the countries like Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, who have already had their own problem with Islamic militants. A few years ago, they were fighting severe battles in Tajikistan in the Fergana Valley there, which is a very important conduit or trade route. So those countries are very nervous about this situation. In other words, it has the potential, as a worst-case scenario, to create a civil war in Pakistan, a war between India and Pakistan, two nuclear powers over Kashmir, and to embroil the Central Asian states in internecine warfare, which none of them wants or needs.
This whole situation, you know, with the U.S. airstrikes, it seems to have galvanized anti-Americanism, for lack of a better term. Do you think that we here in the States are looking at any possibilities of further terrorist attacks?
it seems that the administration believes that there are likely to be more terrorist attacks in the future. There are two ways of looking at the terrorist events of the September the 11th. From the point of view of the terrorists, they could just sit back for two or three years and wait for the reaction, the overreaction, to create more allies for themselves, as they did with the Khobar Towers bombing and the others there. They didn't rush to follow them up. They may not have the ability to put on more than one or two such operations, such sophisticated operations, simultaneously or near each other, even, because it takes years to build up to it. However, the other way of looking at it is that once they get an overreaction, and then if they created another terrorist attack, it would create an even greater overreaction, so would ratchet it up, and that may be what they're wanting to do as well.
You mentioned earlier about the borders being closed. Under international law, nations are prohibited from turning away people when there is a risk of serious human rights abuses, but as you mentioned, Pakistan, Iran, and Tajikistan have sealed their borders and refused to provide protection to refugees from Afghanistan. How is this possible?
It's the law of the jungle, I guess, at this point, where they feel they have to protect themselves by sealing off access. And since each of them does have their own radical problems, then it's somewhat understandable that they would do that. But hopefully it's only going to be briefly, and that they will allow them to come across and things are quieter in Afghanistan. The ideal thing, as everybody and even the UN admits, is for the people to go back to their country and have a reasonable chance of a peaceful life with adequate food. But that doesn't seem to be happening right away. And if you or I were living in Afghanistan now after 22 years of war and 4 years of drought and this new bombing attack, we might decide to look elsewhere.
I'm wondering what folks here in the States, or especially here in Santa Cruz, can do to provide relief at this point, or to try and stop this. And from your perspective, what can people do?
I really would suggest that people contribute to private aid agencies like the Red Cross, CARE, World Vision, and others. Conscience International is a nonprofit organization recognized by the Internal Revenue Service, and you can find out about it on GuideStar.org, which is the database of foundations and nonprofits, GuideStar.org. When you go there, you have to search by typing in Conscience International, C-O-N-S-C-I-E-N-C-E. And that's one way. There are many other ways of helping.
Is there anything you feel that's important for us to cover today?
We need to look at this whole problem about the terrorist attacks and the animosity that seems to be out there for the United States, and to look in the mirror and to see what it is that we can do to make sure that our children and grandchildren don't have to endure the same sort of thing. One thing, of course, is to attack the terrorist networks and to destroy them, bring them to justice. It may involve the Taliban there in Afghanistan as well, but ultimately we're going to have to educate ourselves about the other parts of the world, the part that goes to bed hungry every night particularly. Some people have said that this is not the revolt of Islam, this is the revolt of the third world, or what we used to call third world, which is actually two-thirds of the world who are deprived. And unless we're educated about that part of the world, we won't really be able to do much to change our own policies and change the outcome.
There's war all around us, you better start listening. There's battle lines drawn in our own front yard. Go to work every day for a life that you're missing. Why does life have to be so hard? Why does life have to be so hard? There's a mama who's crying, a child who's hungry, a skyscraper's claw at December skies. The people don't notice, they're too busy fighting for bargains on Jesus and Christmas Eve pie. For bargains on Jesus and Christmas Eve pie. Rich still get richer and can't spare a dime. They'll die without glory in their own time. Just like the pauper, the beggar, the bum. One never knew much and one never knew none. hearts are on fire, triumphant humility roars. There's a man and a woman alone with the TV. The children are grown and never do call. She married a husband and never did know him. In her apron she waits for her savior to call. In her apron she waits for her savior to call. See the young boy with training wheels on. His bike is a rocket that flies to the moon. In a world where children are seen and not heard, his youth will be traded for manhood too soon. His youth will be traded for manhood too soon. I see all the people, I see all their faces, each one the same and each one their own. Within all the colors, religions and races, we're all lonely people searching for home. We're all lonely people searching for home. The heart is the beacon in the darkest of night. The road is rugged and weary with stone. Some choose to follow, some close their eyes. Love is the answer that's leading us home. Love is the answer that's leading us home. Love is the answer that's leading us home.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, you're tuned to the Weekly Freak Show on Studio X. Webcasting in Seattle, Washington at www.microradio.net/Studio X. Please have a pen and paper ready to take down our contact information at the end of this one-hour broadcast. That was Sister Soul with this week's Spotlight Sound. She joined Freak Radio's Feel Free for a live on-air performance. Check out her website, sistersoul.com. On October 10th, television network executives from ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, and CNN held a conference call with National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and acquiesced to her suggestion that any future taped segments from Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network be abridged and any potentially inflammatory language removed before broadcast. The five news organizations all had broadcast an unedited taped message from Osama bin Laden on Sunday, October 7th, after U.S. and British warplanes began air raids over Afghanistan. On Tuesday, the all-news cable channels CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC also carried the complete speech of a spokesman for Al-Qaeda. Even before this, the Bush administration clearly stated their intention to withhold information from the American public. In April 1969, Brian Wilson witnessed the destruction of a Vietnamese village and the killing of women and children by U.S. troops. This experience awakened him emotionally and politically. He became an anti-war activist and a tax resister. In 1987, he lost his legs while using his body to stop a trainload of U.S. weapons headed for Central American killing fields. Freak Radio's Old Lady Scararms recently spoke with Brian on October 7th, just after warplanes started bombing Afghanistan.
You know, the CIA has told us that if we bomb Afghanistan, we have a 100% chance in this country of another serious terrorist act, which I call retail terrorism in response to our systematic wholesale terrorism as a government. But I think it creates such a volatile situation for which you can't predict what's going to happen, except you know that some things are going to happen. We have 1.1 billion Muslims in the world, and immediately surrounding Afghanistan, you've got Iran and Pakistan and the three former Soviet states, Turkestan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. And there's like 250 million Muslims immediately around Afghanistan, and those countries, you know, may not even be sympathetic with the Taliban and Osama bin Laden in terms of what happened in New York, and even if they believed that they had a direct connection to it, they wouldn't necessarily be sympathetic, but they would be anti-American because of our policies in Israel-Palestine, Iraq. Troops never left Saudi Arabia after the Gulf War. Our double standards that we, you know, apply all the time to satisfy our particular security interests. I mean, this enrages people, as it naturally should, or, you know, should be expected to enrage people. So I think, you know, until we understand the consequences and take responsibility for our policies, and not just our policies, but our collective way of life in this society, which demands a militarized foreign policy to make sure we get what we want at our price and our terms, we aren't going to take advantage of September 11th being a wake-up call for the U.S. American people. I'm just hoping that people will ask the question, why? Why did these things happen, and why might other things happen? And that if we conceivably changed radically our approach to the world, it would enable us to feel a lot more secure, ironically, than by continuing to be arrogant and militaristic like we're doing today. It's not going to bring peace to the world, and it's not going to bring security to the American people in the long run. It's kind of a no-brainer.
I'm assuming you opposed this massive military strike today against Afghanistan.
Of course.
You've already mentioned some of the reasons, but if you could just conclude with your feelings on this and why you oppose it.
Well, my feelings at a real feelings level is I feel both scared and I feel very hurt and I feel kind of grief-stricken because I've seen so much death in my life. You know, if we would treat this as an international law enforcement problem, we wouldn't have to be continually addicted to our bully military approach, which, again, is destined to destroy possibilities for peace and security rather than enhance them. So my feeling is that U.S.-American lives are endangered by these U.S. policies, not helped, not made secure. It does not enable us to feel like we really are an equal part of the human condition. So I feel scared, and I feel hurt, and I feel sad, and I feel angry, all of those.
As a vet, you've seen war firsthand. What do you think of the claims now from the Pentagon and the White House that we're not killing civilians, that we're have these smart missiles and bombs that are hitting their targets, and that we are not hurting the Afghan people, we're in fact helping them?
Well, of course, we won't know anything about civilian casualties for a while, because as we said earlier, we don't have real reliable people on the ground there telling us what's really happening. But I think it's pretty strange that there's a lot of people that have become refugees since they have been alerted to the fact a couple weeks ago that the U.S. is likely to strike them with missiles and bombs, and that now we're dropping food to the same people that are fleeing because they're fearful of being killed by U.S. weapons. I think that is very strange. And the smart bombs that we used in Iraq and during the Gulf massacre and in Kosovo and Serbia in 99, we'd have discovered subsequently that large percentages of those smart bombs did not hit their targets. I went to Iraq after the bombing in 91, and I went to dozens of sites where the targets had been hospitals, housing developments, schools. These were all somehow considered military targets to the U.S. I don't know what they said at the time. I mean, they said they hit the Amaria shelter, which was supposedly a military headquarters. I went to the Amaria shelter and talked with several hundred of the male in the neighborhood, all who had sent their wives and children into the shelter, and all the wives and the children were blown up in that shelter. And you could walk down the streets around that Amaria shelter in Baghdad and see the men 6 months later still grieving on their porches with their sons, who were not in the shelter because they wanted their wives and smaller children to be in the shelter. And they were still grieving because the people that went in there to be safe were the ones blown up. So, you know, I can't trust U.S. intelligence, and we can't trust what the U.S. is telling us because there's no accountability in their information system. They tell us what is self-serving to their political interests, and that's why the U.S. American people have to become much more outspoken in their demands for accountability and for information. And if we don't get the information, we have to be more and more in the streets demanding it.
Almost daily, we are told by the media that an overwhelming majority of Americans support U.S. military action in response to the terrorist attacks of September 11th, Opinion polls point to a 90% approval rating of President George W. Bush's handling of this national crisis. But a growing cacophony of voices across the globe are calling for a different response. The results of my own informal poll were astounding. Of 100 random people in downtown Santa Cruz, 59 did not support airstrikes in Afghanistan. In Santa Cruz, opposition to the war on terrorism is manifesting itself in many different ways. Every Tuesday since September 11th, a group of people have stood vigil along Highway 1 to send a peaceful message to mourning commuters. Cassandra Brown and some friends organized the weekly demonstration. She recently joined Freak Radio's Hobo Lee for an on-air discussion of the vigil.
Our object was to just get that there are people out there that are against the war, and it didn't seem like that was coming across the regular media channels. So we just dreamed up this idea to hike Highway 17 to show how upset we were about this. So we got a group of friends, or we just contacted everyone we knew, contacted the media and said we were going to do it. I think the idea of walking Highway 17 was like, okay, what are these guys up to? So the media actually came out. But when we met, we decided that that was probably not the wisest thing to do. And our idea was we were going to have a banner that said, honor all victims of violence and war is not the answer. And we had names of different people who have been killed in different bombing attacks by our hands, and then also the attacks that happened in New York City and Washington. So that was our plan, and then we had placards of everybody who had been killed, and then we wore them and sort of hoped that that would get the message would get out. So we just stood on the corner instead of walking.
Cassandra, what were some of the reactions like, both for and against?
Well, the first week it was pretty positive towards what we were doing. Then there were some people who were flipping us off and screaming war and some racist slurs. And it was the first week, and the best one was this man who pulled over and just cried out, finally, finally. You know, I think everybody was sort of isolated in their homes watching TV going, you know, what's going on? So I think just having somebody out there really helped people a lot. I missed a couple weeks on the Tuesday thing, but I went this Tuesday. And that it's quiet support. People aren't honking horns like they were before, and it's just a lot more quiet. It's a lot more somber, and
we're almost exactly a month past, or just a month and a day past when all that happened. Is it feels like things are quieting down in terms of both support and kind of the reactions you were getting? The reactions from people yelling at you and stuff like that, you're just not seeing either of both of those?
No, I don't think the issue is less. But I think it is less present in people's minds and they're less scared. But I think that people don't know what to think about the war. I think a lot of people say the Taliban is bad and Osama bin Laden did this horrible act and we need to do something. So it's hard to say no to something like this. So I think that's why people are quiet now, or they don't want to not show respect for what's going on. Or I don't really know, actually. That's kind of my thoughts.
You're still doing the Tuesday thing.
Uh-huh, and it goes every morning from 7 to 7:20. Somebody else took it off, went off, you know, has gone and does it every morning from 7 a.m. to 7:20 on Highway 1.
Every single morning.
Every single morning.
And everyone's invited.
And everyone's invited, and, you know, it's great. It's good to get your message out there.
Highway 1 and River Street.
Uh-huh, and we go Tuesdays. We usually end up around 7:20 there, so we stay longer until 8:30.
What kind of numbers of folks are showing up at these?
I think it's like maybe anywhere from 5 to 10 people. You have to be pretty dedicated to get up that early and stand out there on a busy street.
That's one thing you're doing, but earlier when we were chatting, you mentioned a number of other things that you're doing that are related to a peace reaction. Tell us about that, Cassandra.
Mondays, the WILF, they're there Mondays, 5 o'clock at the clock tower, and they're out there supporting, like, in a way of the women in black. And then Thursdays at 5 o'clock from 5 to 6, we have a song radical choir, peace choir, and we started this Thursday, and we'll be meeting every Thursday there and singing songs about peace and anything else that moves us. And so that was a blast. It was really fun. And actually, afterward, two folks that came up to us and started talking to us why we were for peace, and these folks were, you know, so they were pro-war, and we had a great conversation with them. How can you not support this war effort? What do you want? And this dialogue that went on, that was just, it was really amazing. I encourage all those folks that are like, we should go to war, and those folks that are flipping us off, come talk to us. You know, the people who are saying annihilate them, come talk. Let's talk. I think that it was a really positive experience, and in the end, we traded websites of where we're getting our information, because we were like, he's like, where are you getting that? That stuff's all bunk, you know. And so we traded information.
That's one of the greatest things, is when people can freely dialogue, even when they disagree. I always feel that when it's done in a healthy way and people have mutual respect, even when they disagree, that a lot of really fun and healthy stuff can come out of that, not the least of which is education. Like, here's an example, you two different websites that maybe are saying different things. It wouldn't hurt us to hear what the other side has to say. And actually, even the whole idea of there being two sides is kind of a media construct. I mean, there's lots and lots of sides. Mm-hmm. And one of the big villainous things that I feel like mainstream media is constantly doing and propelling people into is these dualisms, right? Like for and against. And it often doesn't give a wider range of the kind of thought and dialogue and feelings that can be out there. And it's just really lame. I mean, hopefully alternative media does better than that. And that's what we're doing here, alternative media. This is 96.3. Free Radio. Thanks, Cassandra, so much. Really appreciate you coming in, and keep up the good work.
A group of high school students have been organizing with teachers at Santa Cruz High to educate seniors about alternatives to joining the armed forces after graduation. Freak Radio's DJ Damien spoke with Jordan, one of the students.
I know there's been some organizing going on up there at Santa Cruz High around the recent tragedies and whatnot. And it sounds like you've been pretty involved with that, Jordan. What's been going on?
Well, we're trying to organize an assembly to educate the youth at Santa Cruz High about the military. Basically, we're going to try to throw some facts out to them just about what the military is. A lot of high school students that aren't going to college, they look at the only other option that they think they have, and they go straight to the military. We want to educate them about options that are out there, how they don't need to go into the military. There's so much out there that you can do. It's endless. It's so endless. And there's so many programs out there that are willing to take you around the world and just show you. Just meet another American just to have their open minded, you know?
So how do you know, like, how are the youth, like, how receptive are they to this kind of movement that's going on up at campus?
The movement actually just started. Nobody really seems very interested in anything this year. We're just basically trying to get stuff started. We just want to start educating people now. Usually happens about in the middle of the year when people start getting receptive and start doing action and start getting more conscious.
On Thursday, October 11th, 1 month after the terrorist attacks, more than 2,000 students and faculty at UC Santa Cruz participated in a statewide student walkout to oppose military retaliation in Afghanistan.
I want you to know that today students are marching at Berkeley, they're marching at UCLA, they're marching all up and down California. Yeah.
After a spirited march through the wooded campus, participants converged at the school's main entrance for an open-air teach-in. Students, teachers, and community activists addressed the crowd, urging U.S. politicians to examine foreign policy and promoting alternatives to war and violence. Teaching assistant Manuel Schwab pointed to the persecution of Palestinians by the U.S.-backed Israeli government and economic sanctions that kill 5,000 Iraqi civilians each month as outrageous examples of our foreign policy.
For much of the rest of the world, destruction of buildings exists not only in living memory, but as a present reality. This is a reality that returned home 1 month ago today. I do not use the term home lightly here. The carnage that some of us witnessed, that most of us had mediated to us by the television and radio industry, is not simply a general catastrophe that resides across the globe on account of a natural human tendency for war and collective aggression. It is a reality that has, in one sense, always existed here, as the invisible side of our government's international policies, as the unfortunate side product of our economic security. To say that the reality of the world returned on September 11th is surely insane. We, as opponents of the present retaliation against Afghanistan, must certainly recognize that war is an unreal nightmare that we must dedicate ourselves to eradicating. But I think that the events of September 11th demand of us a rarely asked, less rarely answered question. When did the war really begin?
Sharon Delgado is a founder of Earth Justice Ministries and works with the Direct Action Network in Santa Cruz.
The people are still struggling with their grief and trauma. People are asking questions in this country, really good questions. Some people are asking, how did we participate in this, in our foreign policy? Teachers and students and community members around the country are talking about these things. It's out there, even if it isn't covered in the mainline media. But it's out there, and it's going to grow. Even though this war hysteria is primary at this moment, and they say that 90% of the public supports this foreign policy that is masquerading as humanitarian, this is ridiculous.
Rebecca Northcutt is with an ad hoc group of one called Attorneys for Peace. She was demonstrating her position at the town clock on Friday evening by holding a sign which read, "Negotiate, don't annihilate."
I'm an attorney, and I'm definitely for world peace. I don't believe that this is a situation that can be easily summarized as good against evil. I believe that we need to examine our policies in the Middle East and stop denying that we're a root cause of this mess that we've become so involved in. And I believe that we should do as we teach our children, which is to use our words and not our bombs to resolve situations. We're taught as attorneys to negotiate, yet our president immediately announced that he was not going to engage in any negotiations whatsoever. That is simply un-American of him, and I am trying to protect my free speech rights while I still have them, and I think that one of the most powerful things we can do, one of the most patriotic things people can do right now, is to protect their civil liberties by exercising their free speech.
Also present at the clock tower Friday evening were 14 women of a newly formed chapter of Women in Black. Freak Radio's Earth Mommer has the details.
Women in Black is not an organization, but a means of mobilization and a formula for action. The international movement of Women in Black began in Jerusalem in January 1988. 1 month after the first Palestinian Intifada broke out, a small group of Israeli women donned in black clothing, gathered at a major traffic intersection, and raised a black sign in the shape of a hand with white lettering that read, "Stop the Occupation." The idea spread quickly and spontaneously to other places in Israel. Since then, autonomous Women in Black vigils have sprung up to protest war, rape as a tool of war, ethnic cleansing, and human rights abuses all over the world in places like Yugoslavia, Azerbaijan, Spain, Italy, England, and the U.S. Arla is one of the black-clad vigilers.
In San Francisco, there's a chapter. We stand the first Friday of every month on Market Street. And that's all we do, basically, is wear black and stand with signs saying to end the occupation and related slogans.
The movement of Women in Black in Israel was the recipient of numerous peace awards, and the international movement of Women in Black was recently honored with the Millennium Peace Prize for Women, awarded by the United Nations Development Fund for Women. So it came as a shock on September 24th when Kate Raphael, a member of the San Francisco chapter of Women in Black, received a telephone call from an FBI agent inquiring about her international connections.
They called one of the members and said she needs to come in for questioning. She wasn't sure what they wanted to question her about. She called the National Lawyers Guild. They called the FBI agent back, who said she wanted to ask questions about Women in Black. She actually had kind of a humorous comment about it, which was that if the FBI thinks that Osama bin Laden has connection with a group of Jewish women, mostly lesbian, then their grasp of the situation is more tenuous than we thought.
The Women in Black continue on with their activities, and new chapters are forming globally in response to the U.S. airstrikes over Afghanistan. Karen Johansson was one of 14 Women in Black who stood silent in Santa Cruz on Friday, October 12th. She explains her motivations and expresses her hope that as an individual she can use her life as an example for peace.
Hearing about this group hit a very strong visceral chord in me, and I felt that I had to do something. I haven't really done anything since I was 16 years old of this nature, so I just kind of got on email and called a few people and decided to start doing this. And my plan is to come here every Friday at 5 o'clock and to stand for an hour and just express my support of this group. Everyone has to act upon their internal guide. And to me, I'm standing here not to engage in a dialect with anyone in opposing war. My concern and my purpose in standing here is to say that I am a person for peace, that I feel it so intensely in every part of me that if standing here simply gets people to wonder who women in black are, that may make a change. If it sparks a child who's sitting in a car to wave and remember this and remember what they read and remember that it had something to do with peace, that may be planting a seed, that the people who came here were united. We actually had 14 together today. So I just think it's about making sure that your integrity is intact as a person, being able to say what you think and what you feel. And I believe in peace. I don't believe in war. I don't believe that what we have going on in Afghanistan is going to solve it. I know it's what we've done many, many times in the past. I don't know how to make this huge, gigantic change, but I will do what I can do as one person.
Women in Black will meet in Santa Cruz every Friday from 5 to 6 p.m. For more information about the international movement, visit their website at www.womeninblack.net. Reporting for the Weekly Freak Show, this is Earth Mommer.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening. The Weekly Freak Show is produced live in the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, and can also be heard on Micropower 102.9 FM Community Radio in Dade City, Florida. The interviews featured in this program are only a sample of the fine shows each week on Freak Radio. To hear it all, 24 hours a day, listen online at www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. For questions and comments, send email to FRSC@microradio.net. That's FRSC@microradio.net. Or snail mail to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. That's P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. Thanks to the A Infos Radio Project and Independent Media Centers for distribution. Our theme music was arranged and performed by Neil Norman and his Cosmic Orchestra. For Earthmommer, Scar Arms, Damien, Hobo Lee, Phil Free, and everyone here at Freak Radio, my name's the V-Man, and that's a wrap.